Will you ride with us? Yes, I replied, hoping that the word sounded firmer in his ears than it did in my own. Good. Nazir and the others have prepared the horses. We will leave at once. Nazir led several horses forward, and we climbed wearily into the saddles. Kader must have been far more tired than I was, and his body must have wrestled with many more pains and complaints. But he was straight-backed in the saddle, and he held the green and white standard at his hip with a rigid arm. Imitating him, I sat up straight and kicked back smartly to start the horse forward. Our small column moved off slowly into a silvered moonlight so strong that it cast looming shadows on the grey rock walls. The approach to the camp from that southern climb was along a narrow stone path that swept in a graceful, even curve from right to left. Beside the path on our left was a steep drop of some 30 meters to a rubble of broken boulders. On our right was the smooth rock face of a sheer wall. When we were perhaps halfway along the path, watched attentively by our own men and the Mujahideen in the camp, I developed an irritating cramp in my right hip. The cramp quickly became a piercing knot of pain, and the more that I tried to ignore it, the more agonizing it felt. Attempting to relieve the stress on my hip, I took my right foot out of the stirrup and tried to stretch my leg. With all the weight on my left leg, I stood a little in the saddle. Without warning, my left foot gave way beneath me as my boot slipped from the stirrup, and I felt myself falling sideways out of the saddle toward the deep, hard drop to the stones. Self-preservation instincts set my limbs flailing, and I clung at the horse's neck with my arms and my free right leg as I swung down and around. In the time it takes to clench your teeth, I'd fallen from the saddle and coiled myself upside down around the neck of the horse. I called on it to stop, but it ignored me, plodding onward along the narrow track. I couldn't let go. The path was so narrow and the drop so steep that I was sure I would fall if I released my grip. And the horse wouldn't stop. So I hung on, with my arms and my legs wrapped around its neck, upside down, while its head gently bobbed and dipped next to mine. I heard my own men laughing first. It was that helpless, stuttering, choking laughter that makes men suffer for days with the ache of it in their ribs. It was the kind of laughter that you're sure will kill you if you can't get that next gasping breath. And then I heard the Mujahideen fighters laughing from the camp. And I arched my head backward to see Kader, facing around in his saddle and laughing as hard as the rest. And then I started to laugh. And when the laughter weakened my arms, as I clutched at the horse, I laughed again. And as I choked out an anguished, croaky, "Whoa! Stop! Bankaro!" the men laughed harder than ever. And so I entered the camp of the Mujahideen fighters. Men crouched around me at once, helping me from the horse's neck and steadying me on my feet. My own column of men followed us across the narrow path and reached out to pat me on the back and slap at my shoulders. Seeing that familiarity, the Mujahideen joined in the slapping chorus, and it was fully 15 minutes before the last man left my side, and I could sit down to rest my jelly legs. "Getting you to ride with him wasn't Kader's best ever idea," Khaled Ansari said, sliding down a boulder face to sit beside me with his back to the stone. "But fuck, man, you are real popular after that trick. That's easily the funniest thing those guys have ever seen in their lives." "Oh, for Christ's sake," I sighed, with a last reflexive giggle of laughter. "I rode over 100 mountains and crossed 10 rivers, most of it in the dark, for a whole month, and everything was okay. I roll into the camp and I'm hanging on my horse's neck like a fucking monkey." "Don't get me started again," Khaled spluttered, laughing and clutching at his side. I laughed with him, and although I was exhausted and resigned to the ridicule, I didn't want to laugh anymore, so I glanced around to my right to avoid his eye. A canvas shamiana in camouflage colours provided shelter for our wounded men. In the shadows beside it, men were pulling cargo from the horses and ferrying it into the cavern. I saw Habib dragging something long and heavy away from behind the working line and deeper into the darkness beyond. "What?" I began, still chuckling. "What's Habib doing over there?" Khaled was instantly alert and jumped to his feet. His urgency quickened me, and I leapt up after him. We ran to the line of rocks that formed one edge of the flattened mountain plateau, and as we rounded them, we saw him kneeling, legs astride the body of a man. It was Siddiqui. While all the attention was on the fascinating bundles of the cargo, Habib had dragged the unconscious man from beneath the canvas awning. Just as we reached him, Habib drove his long knife into the man's neck and gave it that delicate twist. Siddiqui's legs twitched a tiny, trembling shake and then were still. Habib pulled the knife away and turned to see us staring back at him. The horror and rage in our faces seemed only to fuel the burning madness in his eyes. He grinned at us.
"Khader!"
Khaled shouted, his face as pale as the moon-washed stone around us.
"Khader Bhai! Idhar ao!"
"Come here." I heard an answering shout from behind us somewhere, but I didn't move. My eyes were on Habib. He turned to face me, swinging his leg over the murdered man and crouching on his haunches as if he was about to spring at me. The manic grin locked on his features, but his eyes grew darker, more afraid perhaps, or more cunning. He turned his head quickly and tilted it at an eccentric angle, as if listening with feral intensity to a faint sound in the distant night. I heard nothing but the noises of the camp behind me and the soft wail of the wind as it coursed through the canyons and ravines and secret pathways. In that instant, the land, the mountains, the very country of Afghanistan seemed to me so desolate, so bleached of loveliness and tenderness, that it was like the landscape of Habib's insanity. I felt that I was trapped inside the stony maze of his hallucinated brain. While he listened, tense in his animal crouch, with his face turned away from me, I slipped the stud clip off my holster. I eased the gun out and into my hands. Breathing hard, I followed Khader's instructions automatically, not realizing until it was done that I'd flicked off the safety, chambered around by pulling back the sliding return, and cocked the hammer. The sounds brought Habib round to face me. He looked at the gun in my hand. It was aimed at his chest. He looked back to my eyes, moving his gaze slowly, almost languorously. The long knife was still in his hand. I don't know what expression lit my face in the moonlight. It can't have been good. My mind was made up. If he moved a millimeter toward me, I would pull the trigger as many times as it took to finish him. His grin widened into a laugh. At least it looked like a laugh. His mouth moved and his head shook, but there was no sound. And his eyes, ignoring Khaled completely, stared a message into mine. And then I could hear him, hear his voice in my head. "You see," his eyes said to me, "I'm right not to trust any of you. You want to kill me, all of you. You want me dead. But it's all right. I don't mind. I give you my permission. I want you to do it." We heard a sound, a footstep, behind us. Khaled and I jumped and whirled in fright to see Khader, Nazir, and Ahmedzadeh rushing to join us. When we looked back, Habib was gone.
"What is wrong?" Khader asked. "It's Habib," Khaled answered, searching the darkness for a sign of the madman. "He went crazy. He is crazy. He killed Siddiqui, dragged his body here and stabbed him in the throat."
"Where he is?"
Nazir demanded angrily.
"I don't know,"
Khaled replied, shaking his head.
"Did you see him golden?"
"No.
I turned with you to see Kader. And when I looked back, he was just gone. I think he must have jumped down into the ravine.
He can't have jumped, Khalid frowned. It's got to be 50 yards down there. He can't have jumped.
Abdelkader was kneeling beside the dead man, whispering prayers with his hands held palms upwards.
We can look for him tomorrow, Ahmed said,
putting a comforting hand on Khalid's shoulder. He looked up at the night sky.
There is not much of this moonlight left for us to work. We still have a lot to do. Don't worry. If he's still around here, we will find him tomorrow. And if we do not, if he is gone, perhaps it is not the worst for us, no?
I want the guard to watch for him tonight, Khaled ordered. Our own guys, the men who know Habib well, not the guys from here.
Oui, Zadeh agreed.
I don't want them to shoot him if they can help it, Khaled continued. But I don't want them to take any chances either. Make a check of all his stuff. Check his horse and his pack. See what weapons or explosives he might have had on him. I didn't get too good a look before, but I think he had some stuff under his jacket. Fuck, this is a mess.
Don't worry,
Zadeh muttered, putting a hand on Khaled's shoulder once more.
I can't help it,
the Palestinian insisted, looking around him into the darkness.
It's a fucking bad start. I think he's out there staring at us right now.
When Kader completed his prayers, we carried Siddiqui's body back to the canvas shamiana and wrapped it in cloth until the rituals of burial could be performed on the following day. We worked for a few hours more and then lay down in the cavern, side by side, for sleep. The snoring was loud, and the exhausted men were restless in their slumber. But I lay awake for other reasons. My eyes kept drifting back to the place, moonless and thickly shadowed, where Habib had disappeared. Khaled was right. It had started badly, Kader's war, and the words echoed in my wakeful mind.
A bad start.
I tried to fix my eyes on the clear and perfect stars of that fated night's black heaven. But again and again, my concentration lapsed, and I found myself staring at the dark edge of the plateau. And I knew, in the way we know without a word that love is lost, or in the sudden, sure way we know that a friend is false and doesn't really like us at all, that Kader's war would end much worse for all of us than it had begun.
Chapter 34. For 2 months of cold and ever colder days, we lived with the guerrilla fighters in their cave complex on the Shari Safa Range. They were hard months in many ways, but our mountain stronghold never came under direct fire, and we were relatively safe. The camp was only 50 crow kilometres from Kandahar. It was about 20 kilometres from the main Kabul highway, and about 50 kilometres southeast of the Arghandab Dam. The Russians occupied Kandahar, but their hold on the southern capital was tenuous, and the city was subject to recurring sieges. Rockets had been fired into the city centre, and guerrilla fighting on the outskirts claimed a steady toll of lives. The main highway was in the hands of several well-armed Mujahideen units. Russian tank and truck convoys from Kabul were forced to blast their way through blockades to resupply Kandahar. And that they did, from month to month. Afghan regular army units, loyal to the Kabul puppet government, protected the strategically important Arghandab Dam, but frequent attacks on the dam threatened their hold on the precious resource. Thus, we were roughly in the centre of a triad of violent conflict zones, each of which constantly demanded new men and guns. The Shari Safa Range offered no strategic advantage to our enemies, so the fighting didn't find us in our well-disguised mountain caverns. The weather shifted during those weeks to the cold heart of a severe winter.
Snow fell in fitful gusts and squalls that left us sodden in our many-layered patchwork uniforms. A freezing mist drifted so slowly through the mountains that it sometimes hung suspended for hours at a time, still and white, and as impenetrable to the gaze as frosted glass. The ground was always muddy or frozen, and even the stone walls of the caves we lived in seemed to ring and tremble with the icy chill of the season. Part of Kardar's cargo had consisted of hand tools and machine components. We'd set up two workshops in the first day after our arrival, and they were busy throughout the creeping weeks of the winter. There was a small capstan lathe, which we'd bolted to a homemade table. The lathe ran on a diesel engine. The fighters felt certain that there were no enemy forces within earshot. But still, we dampened its noise with a little igloo of burlap sacks that covered the engine, leaving gaps for the air inlet and exhaust gas outlet. The same engine powered a grinding wheel and a speed drill. With that assembly, the fighters repaired their weapons and sometimes adapted them to suit new and different purposes. First among those weapons were the mortars. After aircraft and tanks, the most effective battle weapon in Afghanistan was the Russian 82mm mortar. The guerrillas bought the mortars, stole them, or captured them in hand-to-hand fighting, often at the cost of human lives. The weapons were then turned on the Russians, who'd brought them into the country in order to conquer it. Our workshops stripped the mortars down, refitted them, and packed them in waxed bags for use in combat zones as far away as Zaranj in the west and Kunduz in the north. Apart from the cartridge pliers and crimping tools, the ammunition and the explosives, Kardar's cargo also included new parts for the Kalashnikovs that we'd purchased in the arms bazaars in Peshawar. The Russian AK, Avtomat Kalashnikova, was designed by Mikhail Kalashnikov in the 1940s in response to German armament innovations. Towards the end of the Second World War, German army generals disobeyed the explicit orders of Adolf Hitler and produced an automatic assault rifle. The armaments engineer, Hugo Schmeisser, using the germ of an earlier Russian concept, developed a weapon that was short, light, and fired its magazine of 30 bullets at a practical rate of more than 100 rounds per minute. Hitler was so impressed with the weapon he'd previously forbidden that he named it the Sturmgewehr, or storm weapon, and immediately ordered its intensive production. It was too little too late for the Nazi war effort, but Schmeisser's storm weapon set the trend for all assault rifles for the rest of the century. Kalashnikov's AK-47, the most influential and widely manufactured of the new assault rifles, operated by diverting some of the propellant gases produced by a fired bullet into a cylinder above the barrel. The gas drove a piston that forced the bolt back against its spring and cocked the hammer for the next round. The rifle weighed about 5 kilos, carried 30 rounds in its curved metal magazine, and fired the 7.62mm rounds at around 2,300 feet per second, over an effective range greater than 300 metres. It fired more than 100 rounds per minute on auto, and about 40 rounds every minute on the semi-automatic single-shot function. The rifle had its limitations, and the Mujahideen fighters were quick to explain them to me. The low muzzle velocity of the heavy 7.62mm round defined a looping trajectory that called for tricky adjustments to hit a target at 300 metres or more. Muzzle flash on firing the AK was so bright, particularly with the new 74 series, that it blinded the firer at night and often betrayed his position. The barrel overheated rapidly, becoming too hot to hold. Sometimes a round grew so hot in the chamber that it exploded in the user's face. That fact explained why so many guerrilla fighters held the gun away from their bodies or over their heads in battle operations. Nevertheless, the rifle worked perfectly after total immersion in water, mud or snow, and it remained one of the most efficient and reliable killing machines ever devised. In the first 4 decades after its development, 50 million of them were produced, more than any other firearm in history. And the Kalashnikov, in all its forms, was carried as a preferred strike weapon by revolutionaries, regular soldiers, mercenaries and gangsters all over the fighting world. The original AK-47 was made of forged and milled steel. The AK-74, produced in the 1970s, was made from stamped metal parts. Some of the older Afghan fighters rejected the newer weapon, with its smaller 5.45mm round and its orange plastic magazine, preferring the solidity of the heavier AK-47. Some younger fighters chose the 74 model, dismissing the heavier gun as an antique. The models they used were produced in Egypt, Syria, Russia, and China. Although they were essentially identical, the fighters often preferred one to another, and the trade in the weapons, even within the same unit, was energetic and intense. Kader's workshops repaired and refitted the AKs of every series and modified them as required. The workshops were popular places. The Afghan men were insatiable in their desire to know about weapons and learn new skills with them. It wasn't a frenzied or brutal curiosity. It was simply necessary to know how to handle guns in a land that had been invaded by Alexander the Great, the Huns, the Sakas, the Scythians, the Mongols, the Mughals, the Safavids, the British, and the Russians, among many others. Even when they weren't studying at the workshops or helping out with the work, the men gathered there to drink tea made on spirit stoves, smoke cigarettes, and talk about their loved ones. And for 2 months, I worked with them every day. I melted lead and other metals in the little forge. I helped to gather scraps of firewood and carried water from a spring at the foot of a nearby ravine. Trudging through the light snow, I dug out new latrines and carefully covered them over and concealed them again when they were full. I turned new parts on the turret lathe and melted the helical metal shavings to make more parts. In the mornings, I tended to the horses, which were billeted in another cave further down the mountain. When it was my turn to milk the goats, I churned the milk into butter and helped to cook naan bread. If any man needed attention for a cut or a graze or sprained ankle, I set up the first aid kit and did my best to heal him. I learned the answering choruses of a few songs, and in the evenings, when the fires were smothered and we huddled together for warmth, I sang with the men as softly as they did. I listened to the stories that they whispered into the dark, and that Khaled, Mahmoud, and Nazir translated for me. Each day, when the men prayed, I knelt with them in silence. And at night, enclosed within the breathing, snoring swathe of their soldier-scented sleep, smells of wood smoke, gun oil, cheap sandalwood soap, piss, shit, sweat soaking into wet serge, unwashed human and horse hair, liniment and saddle softener, cumin and coriander, peppermint tooth powder, chai, tobacco, and 100 others. I dreamed with them of homes and hearts we longed to see again. Then, when the second month ended, and the last weapons were repaired and modified, and the supplies we'd brought with us were all but exhausted, Kader Bhai ordered us to prepare for the long walk home. He planned to make a detour west, toward Kandahar and away from the border with Pakistan, to deliver some horses to his family. After that, with marching packs and light weapons, we would march by night until we reached the safety of the Pakistan border. "The horses are nearly loaded," I reported to Kader when I'd packed my own gear. "Khaled and Nazir will be back up here when it's all done. They told me to let you know." We were on the flattened top of a tor that gave a commanding view of the valleys and then the desert plain that stretched from the foot of the mountains all the way to Kandahar at the horizon. For once, the cloudy mists and snow had cleared enough for us to take in the whole panoramic sweep of the view. There were dark, thick clouds massed to the east of us, and the cold air was damp with the rain and snow they would bring. But for the moment, we could see all the way to the end of the world, and our wintry eyes were drowning in the beauty of it.
"In November of 1878, the same month that we started this mission, the British forced their way through the Khyber Pass, and the second Afghan war with them began," Kader said, ignoring my report, or perhaps responding to it in his own way. He stared toward the ripple of haze on the horizon, caused by the smoke and fire of distant Kandahar. I knew that some of the horizon's shimmer and drizzle
might have been exploding rockets, fired into the city by men who'd lived there once as teachers and merchants. In the war against the Russian invaders, they'd become devils in exile, raining fire upon their own homes and shops and schools.
Through Khyber Pass, there came one of the most feared, brave, and brutal soldiers in the whole British Raj. His name was Robert, Lord Frederick Robert. He captured Kabul and began a ruthless martial law there. On one day, 87 Afghan soldiers were killed by hanging in the public square. Buildings and markets were destroyed, villages were burned, and hundreds of Afghan people were killed. In June, an Afghan prince named Ayub Khan announced a jihad to drive out the British. He left Herat with 10,000 men. He was an ancestor of mine, a man of my family, and many of my kinsmen were in the army that he raised.
He stopped talking and flicked a glance at me, his golden eyes gleaming beneath the silver-grey brows. His eyes were smiling, but his jaw was set, and his lips were compressed so tightly that they showed white at the rims. Reassured, perhaps, that I was listening to him, he looked back to the smouldering horizon and spoke again.
The British officer in charge of Kandahar City at that time, a man named Burrows, was 63 years old, the same age that I am today. He marched out of Kandahar with 1,500 men, British and Indian soldiers, and he met Prince Ayub at a place called Maiwand. You can see the place from here, where we sit, when the weather is good enough. In the battle, both armies fired cannons, killing hundreds of men in the most terrible ways that can be imagined. When they met each other, as one man to another man, they fired their guns at such close range that the bullets went through one body to strike the next. The British lost half their number. The Afghans lost 2,500 men. But they won the battle, and the British were forced to retreat to Kandahar. Prince Ayub immediately surrounded the city, and the siege of Kandahar began.
It was cold, bitterly cold, on the windy Tor, despite the unusually bright, clear sunlight. I felt my legs and arms growing numb, and I longed to stand up and stamp my feet. But I didn't want to disturb him. Instead, I lit two beedies and passed one to him. He accepted it, raising his eyebrow in thanks, and took two long puffs before continuing.
Lord Robert, do you know something, Lynn? My first teacher, my dear Mackenzie Esquire, always said this thing, Bob's your uncle, all the time. And it became a thing that I also said to imitate him. Then one day, he told me that the saying came from him, from Lord Frederick Robert, because, you see, the man who killed my people in hundreds was so kind to his own soldiers that they called him Uncle Bob's. And they said that if he was in charge, everything would be well. Bob's your uncle. I never said that again, not ever, after he told me that. And something that is very strange. My dear Mackenzie Esquire was the grandson of a man who fought in the army of Lord Robert. His grandfather and my kinsman fought each other in the Second British War against Afghanistan. That is why Mackenzie Esquire had such a fascination for the history of my country and such knowledge about the wars. And thanks be to Allah, I did have him as my friend and my teacher, while men were still alive who bore the scars of fighting the war that killed his grandfather and killed mine.
He paused again, and we listened to the wind, feeling the first sting of the new snow that it was bringing to us. The shivering wind that began in distant Bamiyan and dragged the snow and ice and frosty air from every mountain all the way to Kandahar.
And so Lord Roberts went from Kabul with a force of 10,000 men to relieve the siege of Kandahar.
2/3 of his men were Indian soldiers. And they were good fighting men, those Indian sepoys. Roberts marched them from Kabul to Kandahar, a distance of 300 miles, in 22 days. Much more than the distance we covered, you and I, from Khaman on our journey. And you know that took us a month, with good horses and help from villages along the way. And they marched from freezing snow mountains to burning desert, and then, after 20 days of this unbelievable march through hell, they fought a great battle with the army of Prince Ayub Khan. And they defeated him. Roberts saved the British in the city. And from that day, even after he became the field marshal of all the soldiers in the British Empire, he was always known as Roberts of Kandahar. Was Prince Ayub killed? No. He escaped. Then the British put his close kinsman, Abdul Rahman Khan, on the throne of Afghanistan. Abdul Rahman Khan, also an ancestor of mine, ruled the country with such a special wisdom that the British had no real power in Afghanistan. The situation was exactly the same as it was before. Before the great soldier and great killer, Bob's your uncle, forced his way through the Khyber Pass to fight the war. But the point of this story, now that we sit here and look at the fires of my burning city, is that Kandahar is the key to Afghanistan. Kabul is the heart, but Kandahar is the soul of this nation. And who rules Kandahar also rules Afghanistan. When the Russians are forced to leave my city, they will lose this war. Not until then. I hate it all, I sighed. Sure in my own mind that the new war would change nothing, that wars can't really change things. It's peace that makes the deepest cuts, I thought. And I remember thinking it. I remember thinking that it was a clever phrase, and hoping for a chance to work it into our conversation. I remember everything about that day. I remember every word, and all those foolish, vain, unwary thoughts, as if fate had just now slapped my face with them. I hate it all, and I'm glad we're going home today. "Who are your friends here?" he asked me. The question surprised me, and I couldn't guess at his intention. Reading my baffled expression, and clearly amused, he asked me again, "Of those you have come to know here, on this mountain, who are your friends?" "Well, Khaled, obviously, and Nazir." "So, Nazir is your friend now?" "Yeah," I laughed. "He's a friend. And I like Ahmedzadeh. And Mahmoud Melbaf, the Iranian. And Suleiman is okay, and Jalalad, he's a wild kid. And Zahir Rasul, the farmer." Kader nodded as I ran through the list. But when he made no comment, I felt moved to speak again. "They're all good men, I think. Everyone here. But those are the men I get on with the best. Is that what you mean?"
"What is your favourite task here?"
he asked, changing the subject as quickly and unexpectedly as his portly friend Abdul Ghani might have done. "My favourite... it's crazy, and I never thought I'd say this, but I think tending the horses is my favourite job." He smiled, and the smile bubbled into a laugh. I was sure, somehow, that he was thinking about the night I'd ridden into the camp, hanging from the neck of my horse. "Okay," I grinned. "I'm not the best horseman in the world." He laughed the harder. "But I really started to miss them when we got here, and you told us to stable the horses down the mountain. It's funny. I sort of got used to them being around, and it's always made me feel good somehow, going down to see them and brush them and feed them."
"I understand," he murmured, reading my eyes.
Tell me, when the others are praying and you join them, I've seen you sometimes, kneeling behind them and not very close. What words are you saying? Are they prayers?
I'm not really saying anything at all, I replied, frowning. I lit two more beedis, not for the need of them, but for the distraction they provided and their little warmth.
What are you thinking, then, if you're not speaking? He asked,
accepting the second cigarette as he tossed away the butt of the first. I couldn't call them prayers. I don't think so. I think about people, mostly. I think about my mother and my daughter. I think about Abdullah and Prabhakar. I've told you about him, my friend who died. I remember friends and people I love.
You think about your mother. What about your father?
No. I said it quickly, too quickly perhaps, and I felt him watching me closely as the seconds passed.
Is your father living, Lynn?
I think so, but I can't be sure. And I don't care one way or the other.
You must care about your father, he declared,
looking away again. It seemed such a condescending admonition to me then. He knew nothing about my father or my relationship to him. I was so caught up in resentments, new and old, that I didn't hear the anguish in his voice. I didn't realize, as I do now, that he too was an exiled son, talking about his own father. You're more of a father to me than he is, I said. And although I felt it to be true, and I was opening my heart to him, the words came out sounding sulky and almost spiteful.
Don't say that,
he snapped, glaring at me. It was the closest he ever came to showing anger in my presence, and I flinched involuntarily at the sudden vehemence. His expression softened at once, and he reached out to put a hand on my shoulder.
What about your dreams? What are you dreaming about here?
Dreams?
Yes. Tell me about your dreams.
I'm not having many, I replied, trying hard to recall. It's weird, you know. But I've had nightmares for a long time, pretty much since the escape from jail. Nightmares about being caught or fighting to stop them catching me. But since we've been up here, I don't know if it's the thin air or being so damn tired and cold when I get to sleep, or maybe just worry about the war. But I'm not having those nightmares. Not here. I've had a couple of good dreams, in fact.
Go on.
I didn't want to go on. The dreams had been about Carla. Just happy dreams about being in love.
Good,
he murmured, nodding several times and taking his hand from my shoulder. He seemed satisfied with my reply, but his expression was downcast and almost grim.
I too have had dreams here. I dreamed about the Prophet. We Muslims, you know, we are not supposed to tell anyone if we dream about the Prophet. It is a very good thing, a very wonderful thing, and quite common among the faithful. But we are forbidden to tell what we have dreamed.
Why? I asked, shivering in the cold.
It is because we are strictly forbidden to describe the features of the Prophet or to talk about him as someone who is seen. This was the Prophet's own wish, so that no man or woman would adore him or take any of their devotions away from God. That is why there are no images of the Prophet. No drawings or paintings or statues. But I did dream of him. And I am not a very good Muslim, am I? Because I am telling you about my dream. He was on foot, walking somewhere. I rode up behind him on my horse. It was a perfect, beautiful white horse. And although I didn't see his face, I knew it was him. So I got down from my horse and gave it to him. and my face was lowered out of respect all the time. But at last, I lifted my eyes to see him riding away into the light of the setting sun. That was my dream.
He was calm, but I knew him well enough to see the dejection that hooded his eyes. And there was something else, something so new and strange that it took me a few moments to realize what it was. Fear. Abdelkader Khan was afraid, and I felt my own skin creep and tighten in response. It was unimaginable. Until that moment, I truly believed that Kaderbai was afraid of nothing. Unnerved and worried, I moved to change the subject.
Kaderji, I know I'm changing the subject, but can you answer this question for me? I've been thinking about something you said a while ago. You said that life and consciousness and all that other stuff comes from light at the Big Bang. Are you saying that light is God?
No, he answered,
and that sudden, fearful depression lifted from his features, driven off by a look that I could only read as a loving smile.
I do not think that light is God. I think it is possible, and it is reasonable to say, that light is the language of God. Light may be the way that God speaks to the universe, and to us.
I congratulated myself on the successful change of theme and mood by standing up. I stamped my feet and slapped at my sides to get the blood moving. Kader joined me, and we began the short walk back to the camp, blowing warmth into our frozen hands. This is a strange light, speaking about light, I puffed. The sun shines, but it's a cold sun. There's no warmth in it, and you feel stranded between the cold sun and the even colder shadows.
Beached there in tangles of flicker, Kader quoted.
And I snapped my head around so quickly that I felt a twinge of pain in my neck. What did you say?
It was a quote, Kader replied slowly,
sensing how important it was to me.
It is a line from a poem.
I pulled my wallet from my pocket, reached into it, and took out a folded paper. The page was so creased and rubbed by wear that when I opened it, the fold lines showed gaps and tears. It was Carla's poem, the one I'd copied from her journal 2 years before, when I went to her apartment with Tariq on the night of the wild dogs. I'd carried it with me ever since. In Arthur Road prison, the officers had taken the page from me and torn it into pieces. When Vikram bribed my way out of the prison, I wrote it out again from memory, and I carried it with me every day, everywhere I went. Carla's poem. This poem, I said excitedly, holding the tattered, fluttering sheet out for him to see. It was written by a woman named Carla Soren. The woman you sent to Guptaji's place with Nazir to get me out of there. I'm amazed that you know it. It's incredible.
No, Lin, he answered evenly. The poem was written by a Sufi poet named Sadiq Khan. I know his poems by heart, many of them. He is my favorite poet. And he is Carla's favorite poet also.
The words were ice around my heart.
Carla's favorite poet. I do believe so. Just how well do you know Carla? I know her very well. I thought you met her when you got me out of Gupta's. I thought she said that was when she met you.
No, Lin, that is not correct. I have known Carla for years. She works for me. Or at least she works for Abdul Ghani, and Ghani works for me. But she must have told you about it, didn't she?
Didn't you know this? I am very surprised. I was sure that Kala would have talked to you about me. Certainly, I have talked to her about you many times.
My mind was like the screaming jets that had screeched over us in the dark ravine, all noise and black fears. What had Carla said as we lay together, struggling against sleep after fighting the cholera epidemic? I was on a plane, and I met a businessman, an Indian businessman, and my life changed forever. Was that Abdul Ghani? Is that what she meant? Why hadn't I asked her more about her work? Why didn't she tell me about it? And what did she do for Abdul Ghani? What did she do for you, for Abdul?
Many things. She has many skills.
I know about her skills, I growled at him angrily. What does she do for you?
Among other things,
Gada answered, slowly and precisely.
She finds useful and talented foreigners, such as you are. She finds people who can work for us when we need them.
What? I asked, gasping out the word that wasn't really a question, and feeling as if pieces of myself, frozen pieces of my face and my heart, were falling splintered around me. He began to speak again, but I cut him off quickly. Are you saying that Carla recruited me for you?
Yes, she did. And I am very glad that she did.
The cold was suddenly inside me, running through my veins, and my eyes were made of snow. Kader kept walking, but when he noticed that I'd stopped, he halted. He was still smiling when he turned to face me. Khaled Ansari approached us at that instant and clapped his hands together loudly.
Kader, Lin,
he greeted us with the sad, small smile that I'd come to love.
I've made up my mind. I gave it some thought, Kaderji, just like you said, but I've decided to stay. At least for a while. Habib was here last night. The sentries saw him. He's been doing so much crazy stuff. The things he's done to Russian prisoners, and even some of the Afghan prisoners near here on the Kandahar Road in the last couple weeks are... Well, it's grisly shit, and I'm hard to impress in that way. It's so weird the men are going to do something about it. They're so spooked they're going to shoot him on sight. They're talking about hunting him down like a wild animal. I have to try to help him somehow. I'm going to stay and try to find him and try to talk him into coming back to Pakistan with me. So you go on without me tonight and I'll come through in a couple of weeks on the next trip out. That's it, I guess. That's what I came to say.
There was a cold silence after the little speech. I stared at Kader, waiting for him to speak. I was angry and I was afraid. It was a special fear, the kind of Arctic dread that only love can inspire. Kader stared back at my face, reading me. Khaled looked from one to the other of us, confused and concerned.
What about the night I met you and Abdullah? I asked,
speaking through teeth clenched against the cold, and the even colder fear that ripped through me like spasms of cramp.
You forget,
Kader Khan replied, a little more sternly. His face was as dark and determined as my own. It never occurred to me then that he too was feeling deceived and betrayed. I'd forgotten about Karachi and the police raids. I'd forgotten that there was a traitor in his own circle, someone close to him, who tried to have him and me and the rest of us captured or killed. I never saw his grim detachment as anything but a cruel disregard for what I felt.
You met Abdullah a long time before the night that we met. You met him at the Temple of the Standing Babas, isn't it true? He was there to look after Carla on that night. She did not know you well. She was not sure of you, not sure that she could trust you in a place that she did not know. She wanted someone there who could help her, if you had no good intention with her.
I was her bodyguard, I muttered, thinking, she didn't trust me.
Yes, Lynn, he was, and a good one. I understand it that there was some violence on that night. Abdullah did do something to save her, and perhaps to save you. Isn't that true? This was Abdullah's job, to protect the people for me. That is why I sent him to follow you when my nephew Tariq went to stay with you in the Jopadpati. And on the very first night, he did help you to fight some wild dogs, isn't it true? And for the whole time that Tariq was with you, Abdullah was close to you, and to Tariq, just as I told him to be.
I wasn't listening. My mind was all angry arrows whistling backward to a much earlier time and place. I was searching for Carla, for the Carla I knew and loved. But every moment with her began to give up its secret and its lie. I remembered the first time I'd met her, the first second, how she'd reached out to stop me from walking in front of the bus. It was on Arthur Bunder Road, on the corner near the causeway, not far from the India Guest House. It was the heart of the tourist beat. Was she waiting there, hunting for foreigners like me, looking for useful recruits who could work for Kader when he needed them? Of course she was. I'd done it myself in a way when I'd lived in the slum. I'd loitered there, in the same place, looking for foreigners just off the plane who wanted to change money or buy some charas. Nazir walked up to join us. Ahmedzadeh was a few paces behind him. They stood together with Kadirbai and Khalid, facing me. Nazir screwed his face into a scowl and scanned the sky from south to north, calculating the minutes before the snowstorm hit us. The packing for the return journey was complete and double-checked, and he was anxious to leave. "And the help you gave me with the clinic?" I asked, feeling sick, and knowing that if I unlocked my knees and let my legs relax, they would crumple and fold beneath me. When Kader didn't speak, I repeated the question. "What about the clinic? Why did you help me with the clinic? Was that part of your plan? Of this plan?" A freezing wind blew into the broad plateau, and we all shuddered, unsteadied, as the force of it whipped at our clothes and faces. The sky darkened swiftly as a dirty grey tide of cloud crossed the mountains and tumbled on toward the distant plain and the shimmering, dying city.
"You did good work there," he replied.
"That's not what I asked you."
"I don't think this is the right time to talk of such things, Lynn."
"Yes, it is," I insisted.
"There are things you will not understand," he stated,
as if he'd thought it through many times. "Just tell me."
"Very well. All of the medicine that we brought here to this camp, all of the antibiotics and penicillin for the war, was supplied to us by Ranjit's lepers. I had to know if it was safe to use here."
"Oh, Jesus," I moaned.
"So I used the opportunity, the strange fact that you, a foreigner, with no connection to a family or an embassy, set up a clinic in my own slum. I took that chance to test the supplies on the people in the Jopadpati. I had to be sure, you understand, before I brought the medicines into the war."
"For God's sake, Kader," I snarled.
"I had to be.
Only a fucking maniac would do that."
"Take it easy, Lynn,"
Khalid snapped back at me. The other men tensed on either side of Kader, as if they feared that I might attack him.
You're way out of line, man.
I'm out of line, I spluttered, feeling my teeth chatter and struggling to make my numb limbs obey my mind. I'm out of fucking line. He uses the people in the slum as guinea pigs or lab rats or whatever the fuck to test his antibiotics, using me to trick them into doing it because they believed in me. And I'm the one who's out of line.
No one got hurt, Khaled shouted back at me. The medicines were all good, and the work you did there was good. People got well.
We should get out of the cold now and talk about it, Ahmedzadeh put in quickly, hoping to conciliate. Kader, you'll have to wait for this snow to clear before you leave. Let's get inside.
You must understand, Kader said firmly, ignoring him. It was a decision of war. 20 lives risked against the saving of 1,000. And 1,000 risked to save 1,000,000. And you must believe me. We knew that the medicines were good. The chance of Ranjit's lepers supplying impure medicines was very low. We were almost completely sure that the medicine was safe when we gave it to you.
Tell me about Shapna. There it was, out in the open. My deepest secret fear about him, and about my closeness to him.
Was that your work too?
I was not Shapna. But the responsibility for his killings does come back to me. Shapna killed for me, for this cause. And if you want me to tell you the whole of the truth, I did make a great benefit from Shapna's bloody work. Because of Shapna, because he existed, and because of their fear of him, and because I made a commitment to find him and stop him, the politicians and the police allowed me to bring guns and other weapons through Bombay to Karachi and Quetta and to this war. The blood Shapna spilled, it did oil the wheels for us. And I would do this again. I would use Shapna's killings, and I would do more killings with my own hands if it would help our cause. We have a cause, Lin. All of us here. And we fight and we live, and perhaps we will also die for that cause. If we win this fight, we will change the whole of history forever, from this time and in this place and with these battles. That is our cause, to change the whole world. What is your cause? What is your cause, Lin?
I was so cold, as the first flakes whirled about us, that I shivered and shook and couldn't stop my jaw from shuddering. What about Madame Jo, when Carla got me to pretend I was an American? Was that your idea? Was that your plan?
No. Carla has her own war with Jo, and she has her own reasons. But I approved of her plan to use you to get her friend out of the palace. I wanted to see if you could do it. I had the thought even then that you would one day be my American in Afghanistan. And you did well, Lin. Not many people do so well against Jo in her own palace.
One last thing, Kader, I stammered. When I was in jail, did you have anything to do with that? There was a hard silence. The kind of deadly breathing silence that insinuates itself into the memory more deeply than the sharpest sound.
No, he replied at last. But the truth is that I could have taken you out of there, even after the first week, if I chose to do it. I knew about it almost at once, and I had the power to help you. But I did not. Not when I could have done it.
I looked at Nazir and Ahmedzadeh. They stared back evenly. My eyes shifted to Khaled Ansari. He returned my stare with an anguished and angrily defiant grimace that pulled his whole face into the jagged lash of the sky.